Okay, good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
And thank you for coming to the GPF meeting today. And I think we have a full agenda with, I think most of them is conceptual framework. Should be interesting discussions, but we start as always with an ISP update. But before that, I think Malcolm wants to say something.
Yeah, if I can just logistics. We've got Frank joining us from Australia, so I think it's middle of the evening there, around about 8 o'clock, 8:30. He will be with us through to lunch, but obviously.
But then he'll fall into sleep.
But
right?
Then. Bob will be joining us this afternoon. He's actually in town, but unfortunately he has some business to do, so he's, I think, on the phone back to Seattle as we speak. So
okay,
he'll be with us this afternoon.
Okay, thanks for that. And update, you?
Yes, so I think in common with our previous sessions, this is intended primarily as a Q&A session. Izzer instructed me to say a few words about the October board meeting. I always do what Izzer tells me. Because the update that you had was struck effectively at the September board meeting. And you might, I don't know, you might have read the ISB update for October, so I don't know. I can talk about it, Malcolm, if you have a preference for me not to talk about it or go straight to questions.
Perhaps you, it's very appropriate you want to talk about it, because actually you actually reached out to us with a specific point on extra disclosures around cash flows and so-called restricted cash.
Yes.
We gave, I hope you got the input by Isabella, so perhaps we'd like to know what you thought about input and whether it had any impact.
Well, I haven't had enough time to fully digest it. It's an interesting, because I think it is an area which is, and some board members, I think actually Patrick has been probably the most vocal about it. Is that fair? I think that's probably fair. it is obviously an area which is of great materiality and of great interest to users and investors. And therefore, I think we definitely need to do something at some point. And the question is, how fast do we move it along? I know some preparers, not all preparers, but some preparers believe there are some significant operational difficulties with doing disclosures on this. But
I mean, if I may just summarise, and perhaps you, I mean, the key points, and other people from the GPF should step in if I forget something. You were focused on so-called restricted cash, and one of the points we feel is that focusing on cash is, first of all, I have to say this might well be a jurisdictional issue. Obviously in the US there's an awful lot of discussion about so-called restricted cash, but I actually wonder whether it's really restricted cash or whether it's restricted earnings, and I think there's a very different. So,
well, I think it's both.
Well, typically it's the earnings which lead to the tax consequences and not necessarily moving the cash around the group. I mean, you can do that with intercompany loans.
Yeah, sure.
And then the other thing is that you focus on a very narrow definition of cash and cash equivalents. Most people, if they have, cash in some jurisdiction that's not the parent jurisdiction, you know, would look for some way of earning money on it, and typically it would be a marketable security. So
surely by
just focusing very much on this very narrow definition, you lead to very easily people saying, well, you know, just before the balance sheet date, we turn it from cash and cash into money.
I hear that point, and if you read the update, one of the things we said in this section is that we're going to consider the need to do a broader look at liquidity disclosures, recognising that point. It's not just cash; it's marketable securities and all the things that you can transform your cash into.
And the board decided really not to go with this cash restriction now, because I think there was two main arguments when coming from preparers. It was one, as you said, okay, it should not be restricted to cash only, because if you have marketable securities, I think, and that most treasuries really, if they are economic interested, they invest the cash in some securities and not having the cash sitting in the cash. And therefore, I think that was the first argument. The second was, okay, it is really difficult, because it was not then restriction. It is economic disincentives for that. I think that was, I think, the wording which staff proposed. And therefore, I think it's difficult to say, okay, what is it? And there is multiple ways to deal with that, because when is it really, I said, okay, is it really already, if you have some transaction cost, is that a disincentive and then you have to disclose that, or what is really, is it operational really to make that? And then the board decided, make it to bring that into a broader concerns about better disclosure about the liquidity situation of a company. I think that was the outcome of the board discussion in October. So I think your input was well received, and I think it was also consistent with what we already heard from the comment letters. That, but it was, I think, September, the board decided, okay, to give another attempt, okay, is it really...
Because, I mean, it really comes down to the speed with which we're going to do something. We're going to do something, the question is, do we try and push it along, or would we have tried to push it along with the other IS7 amendment, or do we wait for this till we get the feedback on the agenda consultation?
And the last point we raise is, how pervasive is this issue? It's obviously due to the particular US tax regime, an issue in the US, these offshore retained earnings and tax consequences of repatriation.
Yeah.
But with respect, you know, US companies don't typically use IFRS, so it's perhaps more of an issue for US GAAP and SEC local filers. And I mean, how pervasive is this of an issue outside of the US? I mean,
yeah, maybe I should give you a bit more context. I mean, what we've got this requirement that we're bringing in to disclose information about the movements in the financing liabilities. And the board was very keen to finalise that this year, because it's something users have been asking for quite a long time. So the board didn't want to delay that any further. And what they asked us in September to do was to see if there was a way of fine-tuning what had been proposed in the ED on those restrictions on cash in a way that could be finalised this year. And your input was really helpful, because on that sort of timescale, we couldn't go for a broader consultation, but we needed to find out whether it was likely to be feasible or not. So you really helped the staff, I think, with the input you gave. And the conclusion the staff drew and reported back to the board was that probably really we do need to do more work on it before we could think about introducing that element of it. Now, how long that further work will take, and you know, to what extent we think of that in a broader context of liquidity is all still to be thought about and decided, I think. But that was the objective, to see if there was a way of finalising that with the other amendments at this stage, and the conclusion was, no, there's not.
So we'll wait till we get the agenda consultation will be the point at which we decide it's where we're
okay.
At.
Yeah, I think you'll be pleased with the fact that the final amendments don't have that requirement that we had proposed initially, Malcolm, but as you mentioned, my big concern with the proposals as they are currently being finalized, there's some wordsmithing that will have to, you know, go through obviously the board review. My big concern is with companies making a presentation of net debt where they don't fully disclose the tax effects of applying cash that may be not restricted, to your point, but in jurisdictions where it's been earned at very low rates, and to apply it against their gross debt, okay, and just to purport to say, now this is my net debt, without giving effect to that additional application of tax, to me is misleading. So whether or not this is pervasive outside of, you know, U.S. holding companies, I don't know, but I can think of a mining company, for example, recently that's been very high profile in the press, that has been giving net debt presentations. And they, for example, are using things like inventory to offset their gross debt position, because they view inventory, presumably, I don't know, as being as good as cash. Okay? So if the reader of that net debt reconciliation buys that argument, that's fine. But I don't think that should be the standard for IFRS. And I just caution the people here around the table, when you go back to your companies and you want to actually make that presentation, I hope you do it with full disclosure around the tax implications of applying your cash balances to your gross debt in a note to the financial statements.
With respect, you focus on cash and not the retained earnings underlying that.
Exactly. Because it's a net debt presentation. So if you're going to take your cash and offset it against your debt, you're making an assertion that that cash is fully
available. If you use your cash outside of, I mean, say you use your cash in the American company that's outside of the US and you use it for a transaction outside of the US, there's perhaps no tax on it, or very little tax. Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't it be part of the net?
I have no problem with that.
As
long as you do it fairly. In other words, if you have a pile of cash of $100 billion, let's say, but to apply it against your debt, you'd have to pay an additional 25% tax or another $25 billion of tax. To me, it's not fair to use the full $100 billion of cash against that debt. It would be more appropriate to show $75 billion of cash offset.
It depends in which jurisdiction you utilize that.
If you have 25 million in the same jurisdiction, I think you can do that.
No question, I agree with you.
So it's a condition.
I just want full and fair disclosure.
Kevin?
And Pat, I'm on your page.
Okay, good.
So we've already begun developing our non-GAAP measure to correct this alleged GAAP statement. Because in our view, taking a short-term asset and applying against long-term debt is misleading, especially if I look at our debt profile. Our first repayment of debt is only due in 3 years' time. So this cash is never going to be used for current debt because it's not due yet under any circumstance.
It becomes particularly thorny when the cash is in one jurisdiction and the debt's in another, as Martin just highlighted.
Yes, and that, I think, would be better disclosure, specify the various jurisdictions, than a pure mathematic. It sounds like a race to the bottom designed by users who are lazy to read an IFRS 7 note.
Provided
so we have to develop a non-GAAP measure.
We would be very interested in your non-GAAP measure, and maybe that's an input to this broader project that we're talking about.
So, you know, it seemed weird that the standard comes out, the first thing we have to do is a non-GAAP measure to correct it. It just doesn't make sense.
That's not an appropriate...
It's not the right answer.
Gary?
Malcolm, I just want to clarify something you had said. You said you thought this might primarily be a U.S. issue. Do you mean a U.S. reporting issue? Because certainly the ability to move cash from one country to another is not only a U.S. issue.
I'm not a tax expert, but it seems to be heavily driven by the particular tax rules in the U.S., to do with repatriation, again, of retained earnings rather than cash, repatriation of retained earnings earned outside the States to the U.S. And, many other companies, might be... have complex structures, but it seems that it's particularly prevalent in the U.S.
I think it's my sense of it is it is highly material to the U.S. companies, but I've worked for three different banks over the last 12 years as a preparer, and in all three of them, this was a material issue. I wouldn't say it might not be as material as...
I would think it would be very material with the pharmaceutical industry.
I would think so.
You have intellectual property all over the world, and ideally, if your tax lawyers are doing a good job, it's located in places like Puerto Rico, Ireland, and elsewhere where you're not paying.
I don't want to get into specifics, but there's typically, typically there's not the, as I understand it, the penalties of repatriation that there is of repatriating to the, again, the retained earnings to the U.S.
Well, that was one of the focus points of this project. Are we focusing on earnings? Are we focusing on cash and cash equivalents? And early on, we sort of decided return earnings is interesting, but cash is how you pay your bills, and therefore the focus should be on ability to move liquid assets. The fact that has to be declared as something, whether it's settling intercompany accounts, whether it's a loan, or whether it's a dividend, you have to declare it something.
But by shifting cash, and again, I'm not the tax expert, but you often get into other issues with setting up intercompany loans, with thin capitalization issues and things. There's so many possible scenarios out there. I don't quite know how you calculate what needs to be discussed.
That's why it's got delayed for more work.
It's a difficult one. Yeah. And it isn't just trapped. It's trapped dividends as well.
My personal opinion is, and was, I also expressed it during the board discussion, because I think to... from a group consolidated company to look, okay, what is really the debt, and then, okay, what is cash, is a shortcut which never works.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think it gets also this disclosure is, I think, of limited benefits. And therefore, I think the board also have decided, okay, maybe we have to do more research and maybe a better disclosure about the liquidity situation of a company, and can you really use group financial accounts really to assess the liquidity situation. I think it is difficult without further detailed information where the cash is sitting, where the liabilities are sitting, or debt is sitting, and I think that was realized, and therefore I think we decided not to make this short decision, to make more proper research on that, and then included that maybe in the disclosure initiative where we want to do more on liquidation.
Perhaps I've hijacked your slot.
No, I think really your input was used by the staff, was well received, and
yeah, and I'd just like to emphasise that the ability to go to you and get some quick, fairly informal feedback was really helpful in this case, and I'm sure it will be in other cases as well.
Well, we appreciated giving it, even if it wasn't that positive for your suggestion.
Well, it helped us get to where we are.
Okay. Sorry, Hugh, I apologise.
So I'm just thinking, in the interest of time, what else I would want to highlight. I guess a key thing that was discussed at the board was the effective date for the leases standard. Which is 2019, January 2019, if you saw it, but with the possibility of early application, but only if it's kind of linked to the revenue standard, only if you also are applying the revenue standard at that point. I guess it might also just be worth mentioning, since this will be of, well, I hope it will be of great interest to you, I'm sure it will be of great interest to you. We did we sought permission to ballot for the principles of disclosure paper, which was going to be published sometime in the first quarter, but might trip into the second quarter of next year. So that is a paper where, although it's called principles of disclosure, it's quite a wide-ranging paper actually, and it touches on things like non-GAAP measures. It touches on, it'll touch briefly on things like communication. It'll touch on a lot of the other things that you would expect to see in a disclosure paper. So how we frame, or how the board frames disclosure objectives in a more principles-based way. And it'll also touch again on materiality. And I guess that's kind of flavour of the moment. You'll have seen that we published a draft materiality practice statement just a few days ago. So anyway, the principles of disclosure discussion paper, I think, will be, when it comes, will be one that we clearly will be interested in your feedback on it. There won't be any, I mean, if you follow what we do, it's all been coming through the board meeting, so there shouldn't be any surprises, but just to flag that. In other things, we had an update on the impairment transition group, and I think there was some discussions on revolving credit facilities and the point that sometimes banks will extend beyond the contractual limits which are agreed with the customer. I think the main point, though, about the impairment transition group, the board and Sue Lloyd especially, there's no intention to open up IFRS 9 and start doing what we've done with revenue. I mean, that's, I think, an important point. So I think this transition resource group on impairment has been helpful in terms of highlighting particular areas, but there is no intention to open up the standard. What else? There was an education session on what we now call pollutant pricing mechanisms. There were some sweep issues on leases, actually, which are probably the best thing is to read the update if you want to know what they were. We agreed a 60-day comment period if you're following the, which perhaps you're not if you're not an insurer, but this interaction between IFRS 9 and IFRS 4, and the fact that the two standards have different effective dates, and we've been doing a lot of work to provide some choices for insurers as they grapple with both IFRS 9 and the new IFRS 4 when it comes. And there was some further discussion of the debt equity project, focused on derivatives on own equity principally. So I think those were then there's the usual things, just discussion of implementation issues. We also had some further discussion of goodwill and the definition of a business, which are two projects which have come out of the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 on business combinations.
So maybe worth just highlighting for that, the definition of business, the board decided the next step would be an ED. For goodwill and impairment, it's a bit too early to decide whether we'll go straight to an ED or whether we need to go through a discussion paper first.
Yeah. For what it's worth, on the definition of business, we'll be 100% converged because the FASB got done first, mm-hmm. and we essentially picked up their conclusions.
If I may, I don't want to hog the input here, but I'm just looking through your paper. I had a couple of questions. Appendix C, you do this list of research activities, so you use a number of times you say that discussions are planned for 2015. Have they actually taken place, or are they, you know, for example, on discount rates and
so on
taxes?
So discount rates specifically, that will be coming to the board in December.
Okay.
The papers are... the papers have already been made available to the board, but we'll be discussing the board in December.
Yeah.
Was there any other particular one?
Well, you got, you know, income taxes, you got post-employment benefits. I think my point was it would have been perhaps more helpful if you would have said have been discussed or will be discussed. Perhaps we're not
post-employment benefits will be coming in November.
Okay.
For all the ones where it says they will be discussed in 2015, it hasn't yet happened. And in one or two cases, it may not yet happen in 2015 either.
But. Yeah, okay. And then on page 18, this assessment phase project, you already mentioned the definition of a business and the goodwill point. So what sort of speed is envisaged for moving these assessments forward? I mean, some of these points came out from the post-implementation review, and is it going to be a 5-10 year project before something happens, or is it fast-track to fix things?
It's different in different cases. So the definition of a business, I think, will be on a fairly fast track because we've already got some conclusions where the FASB had discussed it first, and the ISB decided to go down the same path. Goodwill impairment, it's a bit early to say. If we go towards an ED, it might be relatively fast, but I think there are several intertwined issues there. There's, do we reintroduce amortization or not? Do we think about trying to do something with the impairment test to make it either simpler or more effective? And do we look at whether we should capitalize as many intangibles as we currently do in business combinations? And of course, those three issues are all a bit intertwined with each other, so it's a bit difficult to tell how fast that will progress. On discount rates, there's some staff analysis which is basically complete, subject to whatever comments the board has on that, so we'll wait to see what comes from that. And the output of that discussion would ultimately be a decision whether or not to do some sort of standards level project, but it's not directed at a specific standards level project at the moment. Pollutant pricing mechanism is a bit more advanced. The board's been discussing that a fair bit, has been working through the number one issue in that, which is really, is there an asset and a liability on day one? I think we've made reasonable progress with the discussions, and then there's a bit more to do with that. So hopefully we get to a discussion paper on that topic probably about the middle of next year would be the best estimate, I think, at the moment. Post-employment benefits, board's going to have a discussion next month, or this month, rather. And that's really about, is there some way of dealing with the cash balance plans and the hybrid plans, would we need to do some sort of more fundamental review? I think there's a possibility we might find some approach to the cash balance plans. We've got a suggestion which we think is worth looking at, but it's sort of early days to see whether that's going to go anywhere yet. On income taxes, I think that's very, very early days. We've done this survey, and I think some of you have participated in this survey, and we discussed some of that with you. But that's really just trying to get some background on how people feel about taxes. You know, I think it'll be a long time before we see anything much more on taxes, unless we hear from the agenda consultation that it's a high priority. primary financial statements, I think we've tried to lay out there some of the sort of early steps, which is basically taking stock of where we've got to in the past, looking at some of what was done in the old projects, financial statement presentation, some of the previous projects, trying to assess which parts might be worth pursuing, which parts should probably be dropped straight away. It's very early days on that assessment. I think we'll also need to go out and talk to people about those issues and see where the issues are. So, I mean, we've said in the paper, I think it'll be several months before we even have a plan for that project, because I think we need to do that investigation before we have much of a plan to even bring to the board in draft. On provisions, the IS 37 work, there was a paper that went to the board in July that said, what are the problems that have been encountered with IS 37 in the past? How might the conceptual framework help resolve some of those issues or not, depending on how it's applied? And what we've now said is the next step is to wait and see what comes out of the agenda consultation, and then we'll sort of take stock again and decide whether we should recommend to the board doing a project on some aspects of IS 37. But I think we want to see what comes out of the agenda consultation first. On share-based payment, we're bringing a paper probably to the November meeting, which was looking primarily at whether there's some way of sort of getting some quick wins and simplifying IFRS 2. The conclusion that's in the staff paper is that there are no quick wins, really. It's looking really at what complexity there is in the stands, and it says that most of the complexity comes from the fact that there are two different models, one for cash settled and one for equity settled. And asking the question whether the board wants to do any more work and whether we should think about sort of reopening that question. But to date, the work was just to see whether there are quick wins without touching the basic underlying models. And I should stress, for share-based payment, there's certainly no thought of revisiting the basic conclusion that there is an expense for share-based payments. I think that's a settled conclusion the board doesn't intend to revisit. So that's where we are. I know it's a bit frustrating that there's not more detail on the timing on the projects. And we gave the board a summary of where we were, which is quite similar to this in the September meeting, and I would have loved to put something a bit more precise on the timing, but I actually found it too difficult to say anything very useful at this stage. I think as we move the programme forward, the dates will start to become a bit firmer, and I think we'll be able to sort of be a little bit more definitive about the dates.
I mean, I think we're going to be talking about the agenda consultation later today anyway, but just to make the point, I mean, I think there's a big picture point here, which is we've got a very large research programme at this point, and some of the topics on there are very big and significant. And if you were to do, you know, really fundamental views of things like post-employment benefits, income tax, share-based payment, these are big projects. And it's not so much about our resource to deliver on a significant number of big projects, it's also about the capacity of the world to absorb yet more significant change, and we've already put out, as you know, some big standards over the last recent period. So I think the thing is that at the point at which we consider the feedback from the agenda consultation, the board, I think, will have to make some tough decisions, and we're going to have to prioritise quite carefully. But anyway, we'll come to that later.
Well, Hugh or Martin, I would think, for our next meeting, since goodwill, whether amortized versus simplify impairment, that's a perfect discussion point for this group. And I suggest, I mean, that'll be in the relative time limit. I don't know when our next meeting is, but it's early next year. And I put that in the agenda.
That's a good idea.
Kevin?
It's just a point to Peter. When you first get the initial comments back on the agenda consultation, you may have to go for a more directed approach. The meeting that we had in London a month ago, already there's some jurisdictions that are moving to fulfillment basis of determining liabilities, even though it's only in the exposure draft of the conceptual framework. So you might not get the comment because they've already gone on the assumption that it's going to happen in the future and people can live with it.
When you say some jurisdiction, you mean in local standards or in the way they're applying IFRS?
In the way they're applying IFRS.
What basis?
Oh, I can tell you which. Koichi could also tell you.
But do you think that's a question of people reaching legitimate interpretations of what's already in the standard, or do you think that?
Well, I think they're saying that that's the standard can be interpreted based on where the board's thinking is, and they're sort of going, therefore, it seems to be it's feasible under current IAS 37.
That's interesting.
And it's IAS 37 you'll think you're specifically, I'm guessing.
Fulfillment value, and of course, if you're doing rehab obligations, fulfillment value is very different to third party pricing.
Okay. Any further questions on the update? Shira?
Maybe a last point. on the EFRS 9 and the insurance issue, what are you thinking about currently to try to solve this issue? Because as we know, Europe would like to adopt as far as possible IFRS 9 to give some certainty to the entities that have started that launch, that project of adopting the IFRS 9.
Yeah, so I suppose there are a few different things on the table. There is, first of all, I suppose probably the first thing to say is, well, it's that point I think is important. One option for insurance companies, and one option which would be very transparent to the market, would be simply to adopt IFRS 9 on its normal effective date, and then at the certain later point, adopt the new IFRS 4, and in the interim, to the extent that you have accounting volatility, put some disclosures around it. So that's the first thing, and I would have thought the would be a board preference, I think. I think it would be fair to say that. I think then secondly, within existing IFRS 4, there are some there is some flexibility to improve or to cope with accounting volatility that you would have if you apply IFRS 9, but then have to wait to apply the new IFRS 4, which clearly is the case. Then, and where there has been some more high-profile discussion, I suppose, we have this so-called overlay approach, which would have insurers apply IFRS 9, but enable them to effectively back out the effects of IFRS 9 and end up with the bottom line, which is IAS 39. So you would effectively be doing two financial instrument standards simultaneously. And then finally, there is the possibility of deferral. And that was where the board had a very narrow vote. This is, I don't know if you followed this, this was quite from a due process point of view, to the extent due process gets very exciting, this was it, because the board was tied 7-7 in voting on deferral. So it would be a deferral. What the board's trying to capture are groups who are very clearly insurance companies or insurance groups, because there's a predominance test, which is quite considered to be a very high hurdle, although I don't think we're going to put a percentage in the ED. It's a very high hurdle. So and the board was 7-7 on that, and Hans had to give a casting vote on a later day when we realized that he could give a casting vote because he'd never done this before. But I think it reflects the fact that the board is not, it's clearly not unanimous, there are a lot of people who are somewhat concerned about offering deferral to a particular industry for IFRS 9. So all those solutions are there, and obviously we have to see an exposure draft will be going out, which is going to be talking to the overlay and deferral elements that I just described. And then we'll have to see where that ED goes.
But it is the decision on the October was only three dissenters from that. It was not seven. It was only three dissenting. And I think your question was on timing, and timing is especially, I think we had this kind of comment period, only 60 days. Due process committee has only accepted that, and we are currently in the process of balloting the ED. I think it will take maybe until December, maybe in January, I'm not sure, but I think then 2 months comment periods and then re-deliberation, so I think it is then second quarter next year if we have a final, really final decision if we're doing that or not. That is the timing on that.
But my question is on the timing, that's right, but also on the solution.
Yeah.
Because the deferral approach is not really an industry solution, because it's, if I understand the reaction of insurers, clearly bank insurers will not be in the scope because they are not eligible, taking into account the criteria that has been defined.
I believed, reading the document, that at least all insurers, pure insurers, would be eligible. And apparently, I understand that it is not the case. So there is still an issue for pure insurance, but there is also an issue of maybe competitive distortion between insurance activities done by pure insurers and insurance activities done by banking conglomerates, let's say.
And the board has discussed several different approaches to that, and was also now with this on reporting entity level, which is then for pure insurance, and also maybe a solution, okay, which is then maybe for bank insurers, which is then to have this deferral approach one a layer down of the reporting entity that would be enabled by bank insurers also to use it. I think then the discussion was more or less, okay, difficulties in then to deal with intercompany transactions between a bank and an insurer, how to deal with that. If you have one, then the bank on IFRS 9, the insurers of in IAS 39. So we have to develop then a bulk of really kind of new rules, how to deal with that, because it is, at least I know, I think was the first time that in a group consolidated company, we have to apply two different accounting standards for the same financial, for the same instrument. And that, I think, was my personal view now, I think it was, I think, not much appetite, because board members think that will confuse users if you have to apply once the two different standards for the same financial instruments in one group. Secondly, this was very, very difficult then to come up with solutions. I think EFRAG has and we worked on kind of solutions how to deal with that. I think based on my understanding, there was also not successful in coming up with good solutions for that, and therefore I think that was a reason. But I think we have it now out for comment. And if that is a big issue, I think people should comment on that, if that provides a solution. And I think what for bank insurers, the board said, because the main argument which was brought to us was more or less to deal with volatility. And I think the overlay approach would at least address it, also for bank insurers. Because then you can assign that, and you can use that, I think, for then what you have to fair value through P&L under IFRS 9, you can then book into OCI and can deal with this volatility argument. But if it's not sufficient, I think that is why we have it now out for an exposure draft.
You know, you use the word competitive distortion, and I think in this sort of situation where you're going to do a limited scope deferral, it's by definition a second best world that you're living in, and you will get some effects like that. It's just inevitable, and which is why I think the board is not, you know, at least half the board is not so keen on the idea. The other thing I would say, which I think makes this very difficult, is not just what we say, but we're aware of regulators who want everyone to put in IFRS 9.
But also users was very, very, I think, feedback was, okay, if we have this applying two accounting standards in one group, I think was not preferred by any user, which we have done outreach and say that is really then adding to confusion and was not a preferred solution from users. Any other question? Before, I think we have already 10 minutes.